And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, billed as a first for our country. Presidential candidates tonight are answering questions about the rights of LGBTQ people.
That gets underway as President Trump faces protesters and supporters at a rally tonight.
And an Oregon congressman calls for a boycott of local hotels. How that's connected to the Trump impeachment inquiry.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 10th, 2019. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Annette Newell. Tonight, the Democratic presidential candidates are facing off in Los Angeles in a forum on the rights of the LGBTQ community. The Human Rights Campaign calls this a first-of-its-kind event in the history of our country. As Lily Bolke reports, gay rights supporters say it comes at a time when the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up cases about workplace discrimination.
I think it's important that the candidates make it clear that they view the issues impacting LGBTQ people as seriously and as important as every other issue facing this country. You know, so that's everything from workplace protections to banning conversion therapy to really leading on addressing the epidemic of hate and violence against transgender people, particularly transgender women of color.
That was Zeke Stokes, Chief Programs Officer of DC-based GLAAD. Tonight, CNN is hosting a five-hour-long event where nine Democratic presidential candidates will speak to LGBTQ issues, just days after the Supreme Court heard arguments in three cases about whether federal law protects the LGBTQ community from workplace discrimination.
The bottom line is that we shouldn't have to be coming to the Supreme Court every couple of years to debate our dignity.
Back to the Supreme Court, these three cases will be the first regarding the LGBTQ community since Justice Anthony Kennedy retired. Kennedy was the swing vote on marriage equality in 2015. During arguments this week, Trump appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch aligned with conservatives when he questioned whether the court should take into account potential, quote, massive social upheaval, unquote, if they were to rule in favor of LGBTQ employees. But he was also the only conservative to argue that the language of the law made the case, quote, very close, unquote. Here's Stokes again.
The train of progress toward full equality and acceptance can be put in reverse if the wrong people are elected, particularly to the presidency with the power to appoint justices to this court. Not only are we ready to fight this out at the Supreme Court, but we're ready to fight it out at the ballot box in 2020.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
Are gathered hours ahead of President Donald Trump's rally tonight in Minnesota after his campaign said it hopes to flip the state Republican in 2020 for the first time since 1972. Ross Brown reports many in the Somali community are concerned about Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric.
President Donald Trump arrives in Minneapolis tonight for a campaign rally, but even before touching down, launched attacks on the mayor and the state's Somali American congresswoman. Earlier this week, in a tweet, the president encouraged voters to dump both politicians. Trump also accused Mayor Jacob Frey, a Democrat, of trying to stifle free speech after the event venue threatened cancellation unless a Trump campaign paid a $500,000 security bill in advance. The anti-war committee plans to protest the visit because, according to group leader Meredith Abbey, the president doesn't represent Minnesota's values.
We don't stand with that. That doesn't represent us. And he thinks that Minnesota could potentially vote for him in 2020. And we're here to say that is absolutely not going to happen.
Despite record fundraising, the Trump campaign has not paid at least 10 cities, including Rochester, Minnesota, for the public safety costs of hosting the president. The Minnesota Democratic Party says Trump is spending unprecedented amounts of money in the state, and they are having difficulty keeping up. Trump lost Minnesota narrowly in 2016, and the state is seen as so critical to a Trump win in 2020 that Vice President Mike Pence also will attend. Minnesota is home to more than 52,000 immigrants of Somali ancestry, the largest concentration of Somalis in America. While running for president in 2016, Trump asserted that the immigrants came to the state without residents' support or approval. Abby notes that since then, Trump's attacks have been more direct.
He's been leading rallies nationally, yelling for people to deport the elected representative from the Minneapolis area, Representative Ilhan Omar. And every time he's come to Minneapolis, he's made horrible terrorist-baiting comments about the Somali community.
Omar is one of four female lawmakers who Trump told to go back to where they came from if they disagree with his policies. A Washington Post investigation found counties that hosted a 2016 Trump campaign rally saw a 226% increase in reported hate crimes over comparable counties that did not host such a rally. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Crisis brewing in Washington, D.C. may cost Gordon Sondland because of an Oregon congressman's call for a boycott of Sondland's hotels. Democrat Earl Blumenauer announced the boycott after Sondland did not testify before the House Intelligence Committee for the Trump impeachment proceedings. Anyone who cares about America should not do any business or stay at any of Gordon Sondland's hotels. Nobody is above the law, Blumenauer said. Sondland says the Trump administration ordered him not to testify. He said through his lawyer, quote, Congressman Blumenauer's irresponsible attempt to hurt a homegrown business that supports hundreds of jobs in our local economy is just shameful and ought to outrage all Oregonians. Trump appointed Sondland to be the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He's the founder of Prominence Hotels, which oversees hotels across the country, including six in the Portland area, the Hotel Lucia, Hotel Deluxe, the Heathman Hotel, Dossier, Sentinel, and the Woodlark. Records show Sondland traveled to Ukraine more than once to pursue the Trump agenda.
For the first time, former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says President Trump should be impeached. As Laura Ross Bartellum reports, Biden made that statement at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire.
Former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden is unconditionally supporting impeaching President Donald Trump for the first time. On Wednesday, at a town hall in New Hampshire, Biden said Trump should face impeachment.
To preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached.
The House is opening an impeachment inquiry on Trump for pressuring Ukraine in July to investigate Biden, one of his primary challengers in the 2020 presidential election. Until now, Biden had been less vocal about impeaching Trump than were other Democratic presidential candidates, including Senator Elizabeth Warren. She has pulled narrowly ahead of Biden in the most recent primary polls. Biden says Trump committed impeachable acts with his words and actions, as well as his conduct with Congress.
President Trump has indicted himself by obstructing justice, refusing to comply with the congressional inquiry. He's already convicted himself.
Biden argues that it is obvious that Trump committed impeachable acts. Biden also says Trump attacked him and his son Hunter with lies. At the time of this reporting, the Trump administration is not cooperating with the House impeachment inquiry, claiming the full House needs to vote to launch it. I'm Laura Ross Brautellum, reporting for Public News Service.
Two men linked to the president's private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have been arrested on campaign finance violation charges. The FBI arrested Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, both important witnesses in the House's impeachment inquiry into the president. Parnas and Fruman acted as emissaries in Ukraine for Giuliani, where he sought to encourage an investigation into Joe Biden, a Democratic political rival of President Trump and Biden's son. They also helped to fund that effort. According to the indictment, the men funneled money with ties to Russia to, quote, politicians and candidates for federal and state offices to gain influence with candidates as policies that would benefit a future business venture. The men were also connected to an effort to remove the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, from her post. House Democrats are now looking into any possible connections between her removal and Trump's efforts to gain political information from Ukraine. Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, which issued the indictment, said, quote, protecting the integrity of our elections and protecting our elections from unlawful foreign interference are core functions of our campaign finance laws.
Presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren's labor plan is getting attention for focusing on union sectoral bargaining, a concept that's new to most Americans. In sectoral bargaining, an entire field or industry agrees on basics, such as safety standards and minimum wages, rather than each company bargaining with its own workers. Benjamin Sachs, a Harvard professor of labor and industry, said it's worth noting because union membership has decreased in the U.S. He thinks that's partly because of the way businesses or enterprises handle their bargaining now.
The problem with enterprise bargaining is that as soon as you have a union in one enterprise, that puts that enterprise at a competitive disadvantage with all the other enterprises in the same market. The public support for unions has been on the increase. You can see that in polling data. You can see that actually in the resurgence of labor activity around the country, the teachers' strikes, for example, the Google walkout.
Warren says if every company in an industry had the same bargaining terms, none would be at a competitive disadvantage. Many European countries use sectoral, but the idea is still new to the United States. While fewer Americans are union members than in the past, polling shows that Americans increasingly have approved of labor unions since 2009, soon after the recession.
Joey Gibson, the leader of Patriot Prayer, is using an untraceable church to raise money for his legal bills and political activities. This comes after crowdfunding sites and payment processors severed ties with accounts linked to him and his right-wing group. Gibson's been promoting the Church of Faith and Freedom on his social media platform since last month, asking supporters to send him donations. Gibson says the Church of Faith and Freedom is helping Christians by accepting donations in order to legally fight back against discrimination. Now, there's no record of such a church in California, Oregon, or Washington.
A court recently overturned Lincoln County's freedom from aerially sprayed pesticides ordinance, ending a 2-year ban on the practice. The group Lincoln County Community Rights, an intervening defendant in the case and a driving force in its initial passage, says the fight is not over. I spoke with two members of the group about the story so far.
My name is Maria Soss, and I am the secretary of Lincoln County Community Rights.
I'm Rio Davidson, a member of Lincoln County Community Rights.
So let's talk about Measure 21-177, or the Freedom for Aerially Sprayed Pesticides Ordinance. It was a notable victory for community self-governance in the environment. Can you tell me about how that ordinance came about?
It came about as our first action as a member of the community rights, as members of the community rights movement. And we were all very aware of the enormous amount of spraying going on in the county and of how harmful that is. And we decided to write an ordinance banning it. And the ordinance went through through several lawsuits before it actually became a measure that was put on the ballot on the May 17th, 2017 ballot. And we came out winning in all the challenges that were previous to the election. And we campaigned, had to work against an opposition that was many times better funded than we were. And nevertheless, we won by a very narrow margin. We won by 61 votes.
Wow.
And the day after the votes were certified, we were sued by two companies representing the opposition, and who claimed that the law, the measure had become law, that the law was invalid because it was illegal, because it was preempted by the state. Our question was, or our issue with that, was that people should have a higher right to defend their safety and their health than businesses to do profit, to make profit out of pesticides.
So it passed and then was immediately taken to court. Was it still in effect up until the ruling on September 23rd?
It was in effect until the ruling, yes.
So in that time that it stood for about 2 years, were there positive effects that were able to be seen in Lincoln County?
I think absolutely. There's so many homes and residences close to the industrial forest that weren't affected by the aerial pesticide spray. You know, there was one instance in Seal Rock where, you know, basically the whole entire back of a neighborhood was slated to be sprayed. And so that had to be done with a backpack instead of a helicopter. And then also when you see the clear cuts, you can tell where the streams are. Generally, with the aerial sprayed herbicides, it's basically just a whole blanket of gray. But when they spray it with the backpacks, you can tell that they're not just indiscriminately spraying right over the small streams. And so there's definitely a lot more vegetation around the creeks and streams, you know, in the clear cuts that weren't sprayed by a helicopter.
Okay, and there's also people mentioned, especially people who are chemically sensitive, also mentioned being very, very relieved of not having their usual symptoms of sore throats and difficulty breathing when they breathe in drift, pesticide drift. And people who hunt notice a lot more wild animals around. So those were really palpable effects.
Wow, yeah. The timber industry did not take long to respond. And you touched a little bit on their argument, and then on the 23rd, it was overturned. Were you surprised by that outcome?
I would say I was disappointed. I wasn't necessarily surprised. You know, this measure is basically going against 200 years of corporate-made law, you know, from corporate personhood. You know, the state preemption, I guess, was passed in 1996, but, you know, we're going against a whole system that's set up to stop communities from protecting themselves when it comes to their health and safety. And so we feel that, you know, unfortunately with this verdict, it's a real setback for the community, but it wasn't a surprise.
Where do you think the judge got the ruling wrong?
The judge didn't get the ruling wrong, except she didn't go as deeply into her options for the ruling as we wished she had. The state preemption law is there, but it's a system that it's there supposedly, ostensibly to say that Oregonians are protected sufficiently by the state, you know, regulation of pesticides, and so that people believe that and feel that they are safe, when really what they're doing is letting the corporations do what they want, which is a very partial regulation so that it doesn't interfere with their business and their profit-making. And so we want to call out what's being done there, which is dishonest and unconstitutional. Our fundamental rights to be healthy and safe are being violated so that the corporations can make money at the expense of that health and safety. So, and we want to expose that. And so the people are seeing it right now.
I have like a little bit to add to that too.
Okay. Go ahead.
You know, I think that really she sided with, on behalf of the corporations and the state, but totally disregarded the community's right to local self-government and a healthy environment. And what we mean by this is that, you know, Article 1, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution, you know, says that people have an inherent right to be healthy and have a right to safety. And we believe that these local rights surpass the current state protections. And unfortunately, she didn't really delve into the whole idea of community self-government. She just said, well, there's no precedent for that. So that's why we feel like we need to go to the higher court where we can really deal with the constitutional issues here, because there's a lot more to this decision than just the state here as far as their regulations. But there's a real constitutional piece here about the community having rights to have a healthy, clean environment and not to be aerial sprayed.
So you have filed appeals to this case then?
The appeal has not been filed yet, but it's definitely going to, Lincoln County Community Rights is going to appeal. And we believe that the county is going to appeal as well, because it was also, you know, the original lawsuit is against the county. And then we came in as an intervener.
Cool. So what can people do who are concerned about your case and aerially sprayed pesticides in Lincoln County? What can they do to get involved?
easiest way to get involved with us is to come find us on our website. It's LincolnCountyCommunityRights.org. And we're working right now on a letters to the editor campaign to your local newspapers to really make people aware of how big of an issue this is to Oregonians. Would really help. And then we also are going to have town halls coming up in Newport on October 15th, Yahats Wednesday, October 16th, and then Lincoln City, October 20th.
Okay. I have a question, and you may or may not have the answer, and that's totally fine. Do you know what prompted the state preemption law? Was that created to protect corporations?
There are preemption laws anywhere where companies want to do projects that are potentially harmful to people and people don't want them done, there is a preemption law. If you remember when Jackson County was able to pass its ban on GMO seeds, and they were able to pass it because they did their campaign before there was a preemption law, immediately after that, the state came up with a preemption law saying that anything having to do with seeds could only be decided by the state. That's typically the way they work.
Well, and unfortunately, too, a lot of these preemption laws are model legislation written by Alex. These things are starting to pop up. You know, I was just talking to someone earlier, and they said that there's 26 states that have the similar pesticide preemption law passed. So these are model legislations that get pushed down from corporations through their folks in the legislature. And so as long as they control the legislative body, then they control the entire communities of the whole state.
I mean, people who are in states where there is fracking have the same problem, potentially worse even than ours. I mean, they cannot say no to fracking or to having fracking waste injected into the ground where they live, and thereby poisoning their source of drinking water. They legally cannot say no to that.
Wow. Okay. Is there anything else that you think it's important for our listeners to know?
That it is important to have these issues aired, to be made public, so the public can understand what's happening. That it's not that they're fooling themselves when they think, oh, well, the measure, it didn't work because it was invalidated, so you can't, there's no use going that way. No, there is, it's very useful to go that way, to challenge the state to prove the legality of what they're doing and to expose what they're doing that is not legal. And it does come out that way, and it's very important for people to see it.
I guess my point would be that, you know, this is not slowing us down. We're working on a new watershed protection ordinance that would be talking about the rights of nature for the Siletz River and the watershed here in Lincoln County. And in no way is this loss going to slow down Lincoln County community rights. In fact, it's really emboldening us and our community to stand up together to stop this unjust corporate harm.
Well, Rio, Maria, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
We really appreciate it.
For KBU Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
A young man pleads guilty to bringing a loaded firearm to a local high school. Multnomah County's district attorney says 19-year-old Angel Granados Diaz brought a shotgun with only one round in it to Park Rose High School during a mental health crisis. A court sentenced Mr. Granados Diaz to 36 months of formal probation plus mental health and substance abuse treatment. Mr. Diaz never fired the gun while on campus and did not point the gun at anyone but himself during that incident back in May.
News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the hidden history of the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America, Tom Hartman's new book. At 6, it's Native Youth Music and Public Affairs on Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Soul to Soul features African American news, views, and music. Tonight's weather, clear skies down to a low of 43. Tomorrow, we're looking at partly cloudy skies and a high of 65. Clouds will stick around for the weekend, and we're heading up to a high of 64 on Saturday and 59 on Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1973, U.S. Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned after being charged with evasion of federal income tax. The quote of the day is from Agnew, who said, quote, "In the United States today, we have more than our share of nagging nabobs of negativism. A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals."
Turkey says its military offensive is continuing as, quote, successfully planned in northern Syria. There are reports of airstrikes on towns. At the same time, the death toll of the Kurds is rising. At least 24 people have been killed, including 16 Kurdish fighters and 8 civilians. Dozens more are injured. Turkey started the attack on Wednesday, just days after President Trump announced that American troops would pull back from the area, prompting a storm of criticism for abandoning an ally that helped defeat ISIS.
In China, persecution of Uyghur Muslims has been escalating after the forced removal of the ethnic minority to re-education camps. Now their cemeteries are being destroyed too. KBOO's Jezaniah Hawthorne has the story.
Satellite images reveal China is destroying Muslim burial grounds in what critics say is a continual effort to eradicate Uyghur Muslim culture. According to an AFP investigation with Earthrise Alliance, the Chinese government has demolished at least 45 Uyghur cemeteries in the western province of Xinjiang alone. Satellite images show some of the graveyards have been turned into car parks and playgrounds, while other sites were left disentombed. In Shire County, AFP journalists found unearthed human bones and tombs reduced to scattered bricks at various sites. Chinese officials claim the demolitions are a part of a standardization of old graves and urban development. However, China began a counterterrorism campaign in 2017 and has since detained an estimated 1 million people of ethnic minorities into re-education camps. In response to these civil rights violations, the U.S. Commerce Department blacklisted 28 Chinese facial recognition and AI technology firms allegedly involved. And on Tuesday, the U.S. State Department imposed a travel ban directed at any Chinese officials known to be involved with, quote, the campaign of repression. On Wednesday, China retaliated with plans to tighten visa restrictions for any U.S. nationals with ties to what China called anti-China groups. Amid the escalating tension between the world's two largest economies, China and the U.S. begin trade negotiations today in Washington. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne for the KBOO Evening News.
Apple has removed an app that helps Hong Kong protesters track police movements after criticism from a Chinese state newspaper. The app, HKMap.live, crowdsources both the locations of police and protesters. The company had only approved it last week after rejecting it from the App Store earlier this month. Apple's statement says, quote, "The app has been used to target and ambush police, threaten public safety, and criminals have used it to victimize residents in areas where they know there is no law enforcement." Maya Wang, a senior China researcher with the Human Rights Watch, says the statement from Apple is disingenuous because it did not make any reference to pressure from Beijing. Given the context of how Apple has over the years removed apps and removed access to news, particularly inside mainland China, that the Chinese government doesn't want, I think that the removal of this particular app strikes me as another shameful incident in which a multinational company bends to Chinese government pressure, she said. And Republican U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn said Apple and American companies should not fold to a communist regime's demands to shut down democracy activists.
Soaring medicine prices are costing taxpayers billions, especially among older Americans. Andrea Sears reports it's an issue that's forcing many to make painful decisions.
Too many people need to choose between paying for food and shelter or taking their medications. That's a message advocates for older Americans want lawmakers to hear. A new AARP analysis shows that in recent years, rising drug prices have cost Medicare beneficiaries and taxpayers $110 billion above the general rate of inflation. According to AARP Connecticut Director Nora Duncan, that would have covered a year's rent for 9 million American families. paid the annual cost of college for 9 million students, or bought groceries for 25 million families for a year.
That's why we're asking people to go to aarp.org/rx and tell your member of Congress it's time to take control of prescription drug prices.
She adds that so far this year, 25 states have passed 37 new laws aimed at lowering prices for prescription medications. But Duncan notes that several bills aimed at controlling or reducing prescription costs failed to get through Connecticut's state legislature, including a bill to allow the reimportation of drugs from Canada.
We are confident, however, that in 2020, we're going to be able to pass common sense bipartisan legislation to lower prescription drug prices.
The state also could pass legislation requiring pharmaceutical companies to justify price increases or explain why they are delaying the sale of a generic version of a brand name drug. Pharmaceutical companies say drug prices need to cover the cost of developing new medications, but Duncan points out that 40% of older Americans must choose between buying food or buying medications that may be literally a matter of life or death.
The numbers just don't add up. And the truth of the matter is that 10 of the major pharmaceutical companies, 9 of them, spent more each year on advertising than on research and development.
She says Americans currently are paying the highest drug prices in the world. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Some tribal leaders in the West are dropping out of a task force on missing and murdered Indigenous people. They accuse a state attorney general of a conflict of interest all over a pipeline. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
Tribal leaders in Montana are pulling out of the Attorney General's task force on missing and murdered Indigenous people after he announced his intent to support the Keystone XL pipeline in court. Olivia Reingold has more.
The Attorney General of Montana, Republican Tim Fox, appointed members to the task force this spring. Now, some are resigning because Fox, who's running for governor, wants to join a lawsuit in support of the Keystone XL pipeline.
He's shaking your hand with one hand, but on the back, he's crossing his fingers and telling the state to go forward with this pipeline.
Assiniboine and Sioux tribal member Justin Dupree is one of two who've resigned since Monday. The task force has 11 members, including 8 tribal representatives. The only tribal member who could be reached in time for broadcast says she's considering leaving the task force and is talking it over with her tribe. Dupree says man camps that house temporary pipeline workers would increase violence and missing persons cases. That's something he worries about for his two daughters. Pipeline projects and crime rates are connected, according to the recent Canadian inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. The pipeline would cross the Missouri River a quarter mile upstream from the Fort Peck Nation. Dupree says the pipeline would economically develop some parts of the state, but
the reservation is going to see a majority of the bad things that follow that.
Fox says the pipeline would be an economic boon for the state, primarily filling the 7 counties it's supposed to cross with $63 million in property taxes. He's filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit to support the pipeline Monday.
But I guess what do you have to say to the tribes of Montana, specifically Fort Belknap, who say, hey, this wouldn't benefit us. We don't want this.
Well, I think that I haven't looked at that statement. I don't know that that's a correct statement, because the tax revenues from the pipeline being built alone will be a benefit to all Montanans.
Former task force member Dupree says the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes won't be able to collect on the pipeline's property taxes because it won't cross into Roosevelt County, where the reservation is located. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
A special ceremony was held recently in Canada to remember the Indigenous children who died in the residential school system. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a banner held the names of nearly 3,000 students who died.
The cloth banner was blood red, and the names of 2,800 children were emblazoned on it in stark white. The banner was unveiled at the Canadian Museum of History. It comes after years of research into what happened to Indigenous children who were taken from their homes and placed in the schools and never seen again. From the late 1800s to the mid-1900s, about 150,000 Canadian Indigenous children were forced to attend the church-run, government-funded schools. Thousands were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Many also died. Dr. Barney Williams is an elder and survivor of the residential school system.
There's a lot missing still, but people are remembering that so-and-so didn't come home because
They never came. They just were wherever they were, wherever they were buried, wherever they were left. We didn't know that. Like, I'm 80 years old now, and it's finally to see something like this for me is really heartwarming, and also, like I said, very emotional, because I often, in my journey, often wondered what happened.
It's believed another 1,600 children may have died. The present list comes after the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission called for the government to create a register of those who lost their lives because of the residential schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Scientists say regenerative farming practices that don't use synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides can help capture more carbon from the atmosphere and create healthier soil for crops. Now, as Eric Galatis reports, some farmers in the western U.S. are pushing for the Green New Deal.
Agriculture is the fourth largest producer of climate pollution, and farmers and ranchers from across the U.S. have launched a campaign urging Congress to pass a Green New Deal that supports regenerative family farm and ranching practices over industrial-scale agribusiness. Graham Christensen runs an independent farm. He says farmers across the political spectrum are seeing the proposal as an opportunity to level the playing field.
Farmers have a chance to be able to lead in reduction of greenhouse gases, as well as clean up the water, and at the same time develop a more nutritional food system that probably benefits their bottom line as well.
Christensen says 85% of the nation's $25 billion farm subsidies go to the biggest 15% of businesses, which rely on factory farming, synthetic fertilizers, chemical pesticides, and other practices linked to increased air and water pollution. Christensen says supporting cleaner practices will produce healthier food and enrich soil by capturing more carbon. Critics of the Green New Deal say it's too expensive and argue that a better way to address climate change would be to encourage innovation in the private sector. Catherine Paul with the group Regeneration International says the Green New Deal is an opportunity to reinvest money we're already spending in innovative private family scale farms. But she admits change won't come easily. Agribusiness currently spends more than the defense industry lobbying Congress.
And what they want is rarely good for small, independent farmers and ranchers who are interested in farming in a way that benefits everyone.
So far, more than 10,000 farmers and ranchers have joined the campaign. The coalition's next steps include creating alliances with conservation and business groups and inviting lawmakers to come out and see the benefits of clean land use, along with the economic challenges facing a growing number of the nation's family farms. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
In other countries, maternity and paternity leave are often guaranteed, but not here in the U.S. To spotlight this issue tonight, we focus on teachers who are promoting a bill to guarantee maternity leave in California, affecting that state's 300,000 teachers. Suzanne Potter reports.
Teachers are speaking out in favor of a bill that would grant them and some classified employees 6 weeks of paid time off for pregnancy, miscarriage, childbirth, and recovery. Many of these educators have to use their sick time because they don't pay into the state disability insurance fund and thus don't benefit from it. Charity Berg Garcia, a second grade teacher in Watsonville, says the first few weeks of bonding with a newborn is crucial.
You know, if we're educating kids to make them productive members of society, we also need to be able to invest in our own children and not neglect them.
Opponents of the bill say it could cost the state tens of millions. Governor Gavin Newsom has supported extending maternity leave in the private sector as part of his pro-parents agenda, so supporters are hopeful that he will approve this bill before the signing deadline on Sunday. Katie Serbian, a counselor professor with the San Diego Community College District, says the current policy is part of the reason for the state's teacher shortage.
That affects the quality of people that are going to be attracted to the profession. The ability to retain quality teachers will be affected by this pretty abysmal maternity leave policy.
Natalie Bennett, a middle school teacher from Morgan Hill, says a lot of women try to time their child's birth for the summer, but it's not foolproof. She says many new mothers use up all their paid leave for the baby and then can't afford to stay home if they don't feel well once they return.
Coming back to work absolutely exhausted, you're going to bring home a bunch of illnesses being around a classroom of sick kids, and your kids are going to get sick. And to have that burden of having to show up for work every day, sick or not, is really, really difficult.
This year, Assembly Bill 500 received near unanimous bipartisan support in the legislature. Former Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a similar bill last year, saying the issue should be addressed through collective bargaining. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 10th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Kevin Dugan and Jazaniah Hawthorne. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Chris Gates. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Annette Newell. Stay tuned next for KBOO News In Depth with our special guest, Tom Hartman.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tom Hartman is a progressive, national, and internationally syndicated talk show host. He is also a New York Times bestselling author of 24 books translated into multiple languages. Tom has a new book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Althea and Annette. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Let's hear about this new book of yours. What can readers expect from it?
Well, there's kind of three big bites to it. One is looking at this thing called judicial review, which is where the Supreme Court can strike down laws, or in the case of things like corporate personhood or money as speech, actually write laws. These were not envisioned by the framers of the Constitution. And there was an enormous amount of debate about it early on. But anyhow, we need to have a serious conversation about that, which has been largely confined to the right wing after Brown v. Board and Roe v. Wade. But, you know, we're moving in the other direction. The second part of it is the fact that when the Constitution was written, the hot new things were the ability of average people, of course, which was defined as white men at the time, but nonetheless average people, to own private property and to have human rights. And that was a new thing in the 1700s. The environment was not even a consideration. Rivers seemed like you could just pour cities worth of waste into them forever and nothing ever mattered. We now have a crisis that could be civilization destroying, if not species destroying, for humans. And our Constitution isn't up to it, and we've got to address that. And then the third is, you know, what do we do about a Supreme Court that's run amok? And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different possible strategies to deal with that.
You know, there's the saying, history repeats itself, and there's a section in your book with a familiar name in it, Bill Barr.
Yeah.
As a figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, now given that he's pretty familiar because of the current political situation as well. What is Bill Barr's past relationship to scandal, especially when it comes to Republican presidents?
Well, in 1992, Bill Barr was George Herbert Walker Bush's attorney general. And for the previous couple of years, Lawrence Walsh had been appointed a special prosecutor to look into the whole Iran-Contra thing. Was it that Reagan had cut a deal, as the president of Iran was saying? President Bonnie Sauter had cut a deal with them to hold the hostages to make Jimmy Carter look bad and win the election? Or was it in response to a hostage taking in Lebanon, or, you know, whatever, you know, and shipping weapons? And then, of course, this went down to guns to Central America and cocaine coming back. Lawrence Walsh thought that he had already obtained three convictions, and he had two more that were queued up. Casper Weinberger, Ollie North, and Elliot Abrams were the ones who had been convicted, and who have all kind of returned, although Weinberger's passed away. But he thought that the thing that was going to nail Reagan and Bush, and that might end George Herbert Walker Bush up in federal prison, was that George Herbert Walker Bush had kept a diary of the original Reagan campaign. And he subpoenaed that. And Bush had been fighting that subpoena. And so Christmas Eve, 1992, Bush has lost the election to Bill Clinton. He's going to lose office in about 2-3 weeks. He's going to lose his immunities. He's going to lose all his power. And he goes to his attorney general, Bill Barr, and says, what do I do? And Bill Barr said, if you pardon everybody who has been charged and is being investigated right now, they will have no witnesses against you. They will have no case against you. They won't be able to enforce the subpoena for your diary, and it'll kill the whole thing. And if you have a New York Times subscription or you know somebody who does, look at the New York Times front page for Christmas Eve, 1992, screaming all caps, three line, you know, all the way across the entire page headline, Iran-Contra investigation shut down, prosecutors cries cover up. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what it was. Bill Barr's advice to George Herbert Walker Bush was taken. It shut down the investigation. Bill Barr himself, by the way, was looking at the possibility of criminal indictment in this case. And so Bill Barr got out of it. George Herbert Walker Bush didn't go to jail, never even got, you know, nothing. I mean, he just succeeded. So he's the guy that when you're a Republican president and you need somebody to cover up the crimes that you've been committing, Bill Barr's the go-to guy.
Yeah, and look at what's happening today now with Trump.
Oh, yeah. He's even gone beyond, I think, what he did with the Bush administration. I think he's playing the role of kind of consigliere, as, mm-hmm. How they usually describe Rudy Giuliani. But I think Bill Barr is really the guy.
Now he's traveling the world and trying to find and investigate the investigators, he said.
That nasty FBI. I remember, you know, the FBI infiltrating SDS in 1968 when I was at Michigan State University. I mean, I've had my, I don't know what the word is, but concerns about the FBI. But generally speaking, the kind of investigation that they've been doing in this case doesn't seem to me like the kind of thing that they were doing against the Weather Underground and the SDS back in the day, or for that matter, Black Lives Matter or other, you know, contemporary movements. So recently
the White House issued that formal letter to House Democrats saying that they're not going to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry.
Right.
Is that going to work?
No. Okay. It's a scam. I mean, you know, they're doing a couple of things. Number one, they're trying to throw enough chaff into the wind that average people will get confused and figure, this is one of those complicated things. I'll let them serve. When it's really not very complicated. So you've got that, number one. Number two, they're saying, well, you're not giving us rights of due process as guaranteed by the Constitution and the Fifth through the Eighth Amendments. The right to face our accusers, the right to view testimony against us, things like that. Well, those are things that happen in trials. That's not what prosecutors and police use when they put together an indictment. And an impeachment in the House of Representatives is an indictment. It's not a trial. It simply means we are charging you with these crimes. Now we'll move over to the Senate and you will have an opportunity to present a defense. You'll have an opportunity to see all the evidence against you. You'll be able to have an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, to face your accusers. So it's complete BS. They know it is. The fact that that letter was as long as it was and was so completely lacking in even one single
legal argument
had any validity.
Right.
And the closest they got was the Office of Legal Counsel suggesting that presidents can't be investigated they never even said investigated. They said they can't be prosecuted. Tells me how desperate and freaked out they are.
Uh-huh. Let's talk for a moment about the Supreme Court and where they're at. I mean, there are some really high-profile cases coming up in this session that have to do with some of the ideals that progressives have been championing for years. For example, abortion rights on the line, transgender, gay, lesbian rights in the workplace. Those cases have been heard that this week. Any thoughts on where this court might be going based on what you know from history?
Well, the court has, by and large, throughout its history, been the instrument of property rights and great wealth and power. I mean, it's just kind of the bottom line. There was an anomalous period in the 40s and 50s because Franklin Roosevelt was elected president four times, and he replaced pretty much everybody on the court. And so the echo of that went all the way into the Warren Court. But by the time Nixon was putting Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court in 71 or 72, all bets were off. And the court has again become not just an instrument of wealth and power, but an instrument of the Republican Party and you know, a shill for wealth and power. And that's one of the reasons that you have candidates, you know, Elizabeth Warren has suggested that she would consider increasing the size of the court. This has been done several times in our past. It's been done for purely political purposes. It was in, you know, when Andrew Johnson, after Lincoln was assassinated, there were 10 people on the court, and Congress met. They have the power to regulate the court under the Constitution. They met, and they reduced the size of the court to 6 people. They didn't kick anybody off. They just said, if anybody dies, Andrew Johnson, you don't get to replace him, because he was a slave owner, he was a Southerner, he was, you know, favorable to the South, and Congress, both houses, were controlled by Northern Republicans. And then when Ulysses S. Grant came in after Andrew Johnson left, they took it back. They took it from 6 up to 9, which is where it is now. So it went, it was back to normal. You know, FDR nearly did this in 37. A lot of the histories that you'll read online say that it was very unpopular and he made a big mistake. The fact of the matter is, though, if you read the histories that were written at the time or in the 40s or the 50s from people who were there, it was very popular. The court had knocked down the minimum wage. It had knocked down child labor laws. It had knocked down long-term unemployment. All these things is unconstitutional, and the American people were seriously angry. And the next thing up was Social Security. They were about to decide on that or to hear the arguments on that. And FDR, you know, threatened to simply expand the court and put his own people on it. But Frances Perkins, the first female Secretary of Labor, maybe the first Secretary of Labor, I think FDR might have created the Labor Department with the Wagner Act in 35, the National Labor Relations Act. But anyway, Frances Perkins, by coincidence, knew the wife of Justice Owens, who was the head of what they call the Four Horsemen, this right-wing cabal on the court that was shooting everything down. She went to Owens's wife. Owens's wife went to Owens. Owens changed his vote. The next day, Roberts, who was the other head guy in the cabal, changed his vote. Suddenly the court was voting with Franklin Roosevelt, and that was the end of that. FDR said, okay, you know, we don't need to pack the court. But I think that time may come again.
Mm-hmm. You're making an appearance tonight at Powell's. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah. I'm going to be giving a talk a little less than an hour, just kind of laying out those three areas that I talked with you about and exactly what we can do about this if the court really, truly goes nuts, as I fully expect it to do, particularly now that Brett Kavanaugh is on it. Mm.
Yeah, what kind of reforms do you recommend for, you know, this court that is not this liberal bastion maybe that progressive once imagined it to be?
Right. Well, first of all, the simple one is simply expanding the size of the court, which Congress can do with a simple majority vote in the House and Senate, although, you know, you may have to overcome a filibuster in the Senate, but that can be done. And if we had a Democratic president and a Democratic majority, particularly a supermajority in the Senate and a majority in the House, that could be done quite easily. And there's a bunch of different ways that could be done. It could be done so that you stagger people in and off and move them back to federal courts and things, or it could simply be done by saying we're going to go from 9 people to 15 people or 13 people or whatever. The other one is more interesting, and this was back during the Reagan administration. Reagan came to office, and the Republicans in general came to office in the 1980s, on the back of screaming about the 1954 Brown v. Board decision, which ended legal segregation in our schools, and the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. And so Reagan hired, in the Justice Department, hired this young lawyer to come in and figure out how to overturn these two decisions without a constitutional amendment. How do we do this? The Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, says that Congress can create exceptions to what the Supreme Court can rule on. And so this lawyer, after he spent about a year and he dug all the way back to the founders and everything else and all his case law, he said, really all you have to do is write a law that says, you know, segregation's now legal, abortion's now illegal, and the Supreme Court may not review this law. Mm-hmm. And it's called court stripping or jurisdiction stripping. He wrote this 29-page memo up. It was pretty explosive. It got widely circulated in the Reagan White House. They ultimately decided they didn't have the political capital to pull it off. But that young lawyer, his name was John Roberts, and he's now the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. So it could be one of these, you know, what goes around comes around kind of things. Right. Supreme Court, you think money is speech? You know, you think corporations are people? Well, we can write some laws about that. You know, so those are a couple of the possible ways that, that we could be dealing with an out-of-control Supreme Court.
Yeah, and Roberts is the one who, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's the one who's always saying that the court is not political. We don't have Clinton right. appointees. We don't have Obama or Trump appointees.
Right.
We have,
in our dreams.
Yeah.
right. You know, although he, yeah. you know, truth be told, I think that when he became Chief Justice, or probably within a year after he became Chief Justice, he started taking seriously his role in history. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he became far less of a partisan hack than Scalia and Thomas. I mean, Thomas is proud of the fact that he's a partisan hack, and his wife makes a couple hundred thousand bucks a year at the Heritage Foundation and all this kind of stuff, and he doesn't see that as a conflict. But I think that Roberts is more often than not trying to play it down the middle, at least the middle for the Supreme Court, which has always been to the right. Or at least, on the side of wealth and power, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So,
is there anything else that our listeners should know that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I think that the issue with the environment is a huge one. The Giuliani case is making its way through the Ninth Circuit. It started right here mm-hmm. in Oregon, and it's mm-hmm. probably going to end up before the Supreme Court, pretty much regardless of how the Ninth Circuit rules on it. And because the hot new things that existed when the Constitution was created were property rights and human rights, and environmental rights were unknown. And even the conversation about the rights of nature, you know, do rivers have rights, do trees have rights, is a very recent conversation. I mean, literally in my lifetime. I mean, it's a very recent conversation. So the court trying to put the environment into a human rights or property rights frame might be a squeeze. Mm. Although the Giuliani case, to a certain extent, is we are being deprived, all these young people who sued, saying we're being deprived of our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, basically.
Because of climate change.
Yes, yeah. exactly. Yeah, right. And right. therefore, the court has to say, yes, you must do something about this. That's within the context of the current Constitution. But I think that coming up with a constitutional amendment or passing some legislation or doing something to suggest nature has rights, or at least nature has privileges that defend our rights, should be an important thing.
Well, one more time, the book is called The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. Yep. And you're going to be talking about it tonight at 7:30 at Powell's.
That's right, at Burnside. Yep. And I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
Thank you so much for being here, Tom.
Althea, thank you so much for having me on your program. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been KABU News In Depth. Thank you so much for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KABU at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the third annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. We'll be showing short films recognizing the traditional practices and beliefs of El Dia de los Muertos as practiced in Mexico, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Bolivia. We'll also have dancing, food, and music to honor our beloved dead. Again, that's the third annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m., at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage.